Hi, I'm Lizzie, and this is Once Upon a Coaster, the podcast dedicated to exploring classic and timeless older roller coasters. I was born and raised a coaster nut, come from a large family of engineers, and I have a degree in history, making me a unique candidate to talk about what makes these older rides so fantastic. Join me for new episodes bi-weekly where we'll explore some old classic roller coasters and talk about what makes them so special in today's ever-changing coaster world. Are you ready for this ride? Please keep hands and arms inside the car at all times and prepare for another episode of Once Upon a Coaster. Hello, coaster fans. Hello, everyone. It's Friday, which means it's time for a brand new episode of Once Upon a Coaster, your favorite podcast about old and defunct roller coasters that we all still love to ride. I'm your host, Lizzie, and I'm recording this on a very cold and very snowy day where I live. It's the kind of day where you want to just stay inside and watch movies to avoid going outside all day. So I thought this would be the perfect day to record a podcast instead. Today is our Season 6 international episode, and it's our only international episode of this season. If you love traveling with us overseas when we take a look at some fun and quirky coasters, good news for you, because today's episode from start to finish is full of what I would hope will be some great coaster discussions. Depending on the season, we sometimes plan for more than one international episode per season. But it just didn't work out that way this time around. So if you love our international episodes, we do have some fun stuff already lined up for season 7. So sit tight, and I promise we'll be traveling abroad again really soon after this episode. Let's kick things off with another defunct park segment, where we take a brief look at an amusement park that is no longer with us today. And let me say, our defunct park today is quite a doozy. Since it's our only international episode of the season, I thought it would be only fitting to cover an international defunct park as well. So we're off today to look at Wonderland Sydney, Australia's much-missed amusement park that offered some amazing rides for guests during its years of operation. Wonderland Sydney was the collaboration and brainchild of several large corporations and/or people who were looking to expand the theme park industry around the world. When the park opened in 1985, ownership felt there was a large need for an amusement park in the Sydney area, as Luna Park Sydney was struggling at the time, opening and closing several times throughout the 1980s as their ownership struggled with financial hardships. At the time, the parties involved in creating Wonderland Sydney included the New South Wales State Board, James Hardie Industries, Leighton Holdings, and Taft Broadcasting. And yes, Taft Broadcasting, as in the owners, at the time, of parks such as Kings Island and Kings Dominion in the United States. The idea to bring a large-scale amusement park to Eastern Australia wasn't a new concept in the 1980s, as Disney Parks, of all businesses, looked at the same move several times over the years before eventually deciding to build a park elsewhere, whether it was Tokyo or Hong Kong or Shanghai. While Disney Parks ultimately decided to pass on Australia, Taft Broadcasting felt it was the perfect location for them to spread their theme park knowledge in an international setting, and decided to sign on as a minority stakeholder. The park opened to much fanfare on December 7, 1985, with the park officially being opened by Neville Ran, the premier of New South Wales at the time. For those of you not fully invested in Australian politics from the 1980s, first off, how dare you not be fully invested in Australian politics from the 1980s? But second, and more importantly, the choice of Neville Ran to be, you know, the MC of the opening day was, in hindsight, a bit ironic. If you've seen the documentary Exposed, The Ghost Train Fire, that first premiered in Australia on ABC in 2021, and eventually made its way to Netflix for many international viewers, Neville Ran is accused in that documentary of being involved in covering up the fire on the ghost train ride at Luna Park Sydney that killed 7 people in 1979. In the documentary, spokespeople for the late Ran denied he had any knowledge or involvement in the wrongdoing. But as we look back at the opening of Wonderland Sydney, the park that was built in part as direct competition for Luna Park Sydney, It does seem like a large coincidence that he should be offered to open this new theme park 6 years after the tragic fire. I'm not trying to speculate here at all. You definitely should watch the documentary if you haven't already. It's quite the tale. And again, Rand's spokespeople firmly deny that there was any misdoing on his part with the tragic death at the theme park. But I did see his name pop up during the segment's research, and all I could really think was, really? Are you serious here? But I'll leave it at that, and I'll let you form your own opinions about the opening and Neville Rand. But anyway, back to Wonderland Sydney. The park opened in late 1985 during the summer holidays to much fanfare from the surrounding areas. The park premiered with three main lands for guests to explore: Gold Rush, themed around the American Wild West; Medieval Fair, which obviously was medieval European themed; and Hanna-Barbera Land, where guests could meet Hanna-Barbera characters such as Yogi Bear, Scooby-Doo, and the Flintstones. While Taft Broadcasting held only a minor interest in the park, their influence can be seen on many areas of Wonderland Sydney, from concept and design to actual ride construction. First, as we just said, Wonderland Sydney benefited from their relationship with Taft Broadcasting through the licensing agreement they already had in place with Hanna-Barbera at their North American parks. If you have pictures growing up in the 1970s or 1980s of you meeting Yogi Bear at King's Island or Fred Flintstone at King's Dominion, just know that halfway around the world, similar pictures were being taken at Wonderland Sydney through the same licensing deal. The park was also heavily modeled around the design and layout of Canada's Wonderland, another park in the Taft portfolio that had opened outside Toronto in 1981. And in my opinion, this isn't the worst park to model a brand new park after. Canada's Wonderland is really well designed, and Wonderland Sydney surely benefited from the copycatting of the park to Australia. For years, the main attraction at the park was a wooden roller coaster named the Bush Beast, which lasted from park's opening day to its closing day. The Bush Beast was manufactured by Taft Broadcasting specifically for the park, and, well, let's just say it had a lot of similarities to other wooden roller coasters found throughout the Taft Broadcasting chain, including Grizzly at King's Dominion, Wildebeest at Canada's Wonderland, and the Beast at King's Island. The logo actually for the ride is an exact ripoff of the Beast's original logo, which apparently park management felt worked so well for their American audience that their Australian guests would appreciate it too. I guess they did appreciate it, in all fairness, as the Bush Beast remained a popular attraction, if not the main draw at the park, for the entire park's existence. So for several years, really a whole decade of operation, things remained pretty good for the park. They continued to add more rides and attractions for guests. Guests continued to show up and enjoy the park on holidays. Money and profits were up. It was honestly a win-win all around. And really, it should have been, with Taft Broadcasting being such an influence on the park setup. They had several successful parks already up and running by the time Wonderland Sydney opened, so they brought that experience to this project, and it would be hard to replace that should they ever leave this partnership. But that's kind of where the wheels on Wonderland began to fall off. In 1992, only 7 years after Wonderland Sydney opened, Taft Broadcasting sold all of their parks to Viacom, who rebranded them as Paramount Parks. Because Taft Broadcasting wasn't a majority owner in Wonderland Sydney, that park was not part of the Viacom deal. However, wanting to completely exit the theme park industry they had spent the past 20 plus years perfecting, Taft at the same time sold their shares in Wonderland Sydney to other Australian investors who were looking to capitalize on the success of the park. Here's the thing though, we know this, but just in case it needs to be stated again, money alone doesn't make a theme park successful, and Wonderland Sydney was about to find this out the hard way. Without Taft behind the park's vision, management struggled to figure out how to continue to grow the park in a way that would continue to attract guests to return season after season. Essentially, they put profit above the park. In 1997, the park was sold to Sunway Group, a Malaysian conglomerate company that had literally zero idea how to run an amusement park. The sale to Sunway Group would be the final nail in the coffin for Wonderland Sydney, though at the time, no one realized how extensive the damage would be to the park or the brand. Sunway Group, who, again, had never invested in a theme park of the size and scope of Wonderland Sydney before or since, as far as my research could find, figured that a fully developed theme park in the populous Sydney metro area would basically run itself with little or no input needed from them. From 1997, when Sunway Group purchased Wonderland Sydney, to 2004, when the park finally closed, only one new ride was added to the park. Sunway Group mismanaged the property so badly that almost overnight, the land that visitors had once flocked to for vacation fun became a near ghost town. Budgets were slashed, regularly scheduled repairs were cut, and the overall feeling of the park was one of unkemptness and lack of anything worth visiting. The park limped into the 2000s, but the writing was already on the wall for the once great Wonderland Sydney. The park opened for its final day on April 26, 2004, before closing its gates for good. Most of the rides were sold to competing parks, though the Bush Beast was demolished after sitting abandoned for over a year. In a statement for the park's closing, the CEO of Sunway Group, Stephen Galbraith, stated that there were many factors that contributed to Wonderland Sydney's closing. He listed the September 11th bombings, the Iraq War, the SARS virus, the Asian financial crisis, and quite a few more excuses, really. However, the Sydney Morning Herald's write-up of the closing seemed to take a more pointed view on the park, blaming poor management from Sunway Group as the main reason that Wonderland Sydney ultimately failed. Today, the grounds that once housed the wonderful park have been turned into an industrial park, with very few signs remaining that the property once housed huge rides. One of the only nods to the former park comes from a street that runs through the industrial complex that is named Wonderland Drive. Wonderland Sydney is a classic story of companies who have no business running theme parks who thought that they could do exactly that in the 70s, 80s, and 90s. We saw a lot of that here in North America. Marriott, Paramount Pictures, Anheuser-Busch, all of them saw the model that Walt Disney achieved with Disneyland and they thought, hey, this should be really easy to replicate. But as I said earlier, it takes more than just money to operate a successful theme park, no matter how big or how small the park might be. So many of the defunct parks we have looked at over the run of this podcast, they have a similar story. An owner who knew how to run a theme park is no longer in charge. Maybe they pass away, maybe they sell it, maybe they retire. But when new management comes in, they are looking at nothing more than maximizing profits, which often leads to little or no investments in the park. And as we've seen time and time again, that's never a recipe for success in the theme park industry. The story for Wonderland Sydney might have been so much different if only TAF Broadcasting had owned a bigger share of the park at the time they sold to Viacom. It's all speculation, of course, but maybe Viacom would have swallowed the park up into their portfolio too and eventually sold it to Cedar Fair. Maybe it would still be under Cedar Fair's ownership and be open for guests today. Maybe not too. While Toronto isn't that far of an international trip from Cedar Fair's headquarters in Ohio, Sydney most definitely is. Honestly, the future of the park could have easily been decided long before Sunway Group got their hands on it. But at the end of the day, the doom of Wonderland Sydney came down to corporate mismanagement and budget cuts. And through it all, Eastern Australia lost what could have been a phenomenal park if it was still open today. I have to say, the defunct park segment we do on this podcast are some of my favorite. I love digging into these old parks, both big and small, and seeing what made them tick and what eventually spelled out their final days for them. In another life, I would probably set up a podcast series that looks more in depth at these failures, but there are just not enough hours in the day to cover it all, so I guess I'll just have to be content with talking about them here sometimes on Once Upon a Coaster. For now, though, let's pause for a minute and take an ad break. When we return, we'll be staying in the Eastern Hemisphere for our main coaster of the episode, taking a look at the absolute delight of a park that was Nara Dreamland in Japan. Sit tight, we'll be right back. Sometimes it's so hard to wait for the things that we love. Vacations, visit with friends and families, and podcasts? Do you miss Once Upon a Coaster between seasons, or even between episodes? Waiting for a new season of your favorite roller coaster podcast can be hard, but we've made the waiting a little easier by teaming up with Buy Me a Coffee to give our listeners the chance for roller coaster extras to enjoy between seasons or episodes or whenever you have the time. At buymeacoffee.com/OUA coaster, we're talking about roller coasters all the time and would love for you to join us. There's a lot of free stuff over there for you to view, but if you're interested in even more fun from our team, you can become a member and unlock all the fun that we're having. For as little as $1 a month, you can unlock exclusive content like our defunct amusement park series, a look at old and abandoned amusement parks around the world, as well as our coffee break chats where we discuss current roller coasters and amusement park news. Subscribers can also gain access to perks like early episode releases, free swag, social media shoutouts, and so much more. If you miss our podcast between seasons or just want to support a small but growing podcast, be sure to head over to buymeacoffee.com/OUA coaster and join our support team. That's buymeacoffee.com/OUA coaster. Let's talk about coasters together. Well, hello again. Let's get settled in and ready to talk about this week's main roller coaster. Today, we are heading to Japan to take a look at bobsleigh at Nara Dreamland, a defunct roller coaster at a defunct theme park that has a wonderful story to be told. Bobsleigh is an amazing defunct coaster to look at, and we'll get to it in a few minutes here. However, for you to fully appreciate the story of this roller coaster, you first have to understand the story of Nara Dreamland and the Japanese theme park industry during the mid-20th century. Nara Dreamland started as an idea that Japanese businessman Kunitsu Matsuo had in the mid-1950s. He visited California on a business trip and specifically went to the newly opened Disneyland in Anaheim. He felt that the large-scale theme park could successfully be replicated in Japan. Matsuo was what you might call an old-school businessman. Born in the late 1800s, he would become a billionaire before his death in 1984. He lived through a lot of turmoil and change in Japan in the 20th century, not just limited to World War II, and felt that by the 1950s, Japan was looking to embrace a more Western attitude for entertainment as they emerged from rebuilding their lives after the war. Visiting Disneyland then must have been the ultimate Western destination for Matsuo, and it's of little surprise that he felt he could bring this same concept to Japan. Matsuo met with Walt Disney himself to discuss the idea of opening a Disney park in Japan. No formal agreement was ever made, but from what history records show, it seems Walt Disney was fine with the idea. You know, kind of like a shrug and sure if you want agreement between two businessmen. In the future, this lack of a formal agreement would spell the absolute end of Nara Dreamland, but in the late 1950s, it was all of the green light that Matsuo needed to really get to work on his dream park. Matsuo began construction on his park in Nara, Japan, with the oversight of Walt and his team of Imagineers. The location of Nara was chosen as the park's location due to Matsuo's personal background. He made much of his early fortune as a kabuki actor, and desired to promote the culture and history of Japan in the theme park he built. Nara was the first officially established capital of Japan, dating back to the 700s, prior to the capital being changed to Kyoto up until the 1800s. Maybe that's more Japanese history than you expected from a roller coaster podcast today. But just know that the city of Nara has historical and cultural significance in Japan, and Matsuo felt it would be the perfect place to build out his Japanese Disneyland. The layout of Nara Dreamland was very similar to Disneyland, down to replicating much of the scenery, much of the theme lands, and many of the rides that the original Anaheim park offered. Fantasyland, Main Street USA, and a futuristic Tomorrowland would all be built at Nara Dreamland. The only major change in the original design was to change Frontierland to Ancestral Land, as Japanese visitors would be unfamiliar with the American Wild West in the 1960s. Things seemed to be going great for the park construction, until suddenly it wasn't. As construction on the park was nearing completion, talks broke down between Disney and Matsuo over a licensing agreement to use Disney characters at the new Dreamland. This disagreement was never resolved, and Disney and his team basically walked away from the gentleman's agreement that had been established between the two parties, essentially bringing to an end the idea that Dreamland would become the first international Disney theme park. With the park so close to completion, though, Matsuo wasn't going to just close up shop and head home. He pushed forward with the final months of construction, changing the brand to not include any Disney Studio characters in the park. However, despite the lack of Snow White, Pinocchio, and Mickey sprinkled throughout the park, there was no denying that this was almost a carbon copy of Disneyland. Built at a time when a licensing agreement seemed to be the logical next step that would happen. Over the years at Dreamland Stood, many visitors would, I don't know what the right word is here, mock, complain, observe, one of these actions. Visitors would notice and point out that Dreamland looks like a cheap Disney knockoff. But in most instances, what a lot of these guests didn't understand was that Dreamland was never created to be a knockoff. It was created to be an original Disney theme park. But the deal fell through at the last minute, leaving the park feeling a bit like a shell of itself and a bit of a shell of what it might have become. However, this did not stop the park from opening on July 1st, 1961, to much fanfare throughout the region. The 1960s was a huge decade for Japan, a decade that pushed them to the forefront of world leaders in manufacturing, leisure, and technology. Two decades removed from World War II, a new generation of young leaders had taken over the country, one that wanted to grow the economy to allow for the growth of a large leisure and tourism industry to flourish. NARA Dreamland, then, came along at the perfect time in many respects, as citizens finally had the financial means to enjoy a day at a theme park. And they embraced many of the Western culture ideologies that had remained in the country since the end of the war. Dreamland, then, was a success in every sense of the word when it first opened, attracting both locals and out-of-town guests to behold the new magical property that had been inspired by Disneyland. At the height of its popularity, 1.7 million guests would take a spin through the front turnstiles at the park in a single operating season. And it's at this moment in Dreamland's history that we're finally going to talk about bobsleigh, the iconic roller coaster that featured heavily into what the park became in the 20th century. Bobsleigh, in many ways, came to represent the early success that Dreamland found in Japan, a large-scale, thrilling steel roller coaster built around a large, man-made mountain structure. In other ways, though, bobsleigh would eventually represent everything that failed at the park, a reminder of a Disney deal that almost happened, but never quite made it over the finish line. Bobsleigh was a steel roller coaster that was based heavily on the newly designed Matterhorn bobsleds at Disneyland. Much like the original Matterhorn, bobsleigh would be built around a large mountain that would transport guests to a quaint and far-off snowy mountain region, complete with a ride to entertain guests. The large mountain that was constructed on Dreamland's property featured much of the same iconic items that the Matterhorn property did. Snow-capped mountain peaks, water features, and even an opening at the top of the structure to allow for a sky ride to pass through. If you listened to our episode on Matterhorn last season, you know that the original coaster once had a sky ride travel through the Alp structure at Disneyland, but it was removed some years later due to repairs that needed to be made to help the supports. You'll also know that I miss the Disneyland sky ride a lot. So there's some satisfaction on my end knowing that not only did Dreamland replicate the sky ride at their park, but they managed to keep it open for the entirety of the park's lifespan. But anyway, this is not an episode on Matterhorn. We already did that. This is an episode on bobsleigh. Let's talk about some stats on the ride. Bobsleigh was a custom steel coaster that debuted at Dreamland on opening day in 1961. The coaster featured a total ride time of 1 minute and 35 seconds. The top speed was 37 miles per hour, or 60 kilometers per hour. The total track length was 2,788 feet, or 850 meters. Making this a fairly large roller coaster for the time she was built in 1961. The ride features zero inversions, a typical chainlift hill, and riders sitting single file behind each other, with each train holding two riders total. Two trains were coupled together for each ride, meaning that four riders experienced the coaster at the same time. The low number of riders meant that the hourly number of guest throughput for bobsleigh was very small. Estimates have guessed that on a fully operational park day, the ride would see about 350 guests per hour. For the record, the Jungle Cruise at Disneyland has a guest throughput of about 1,500 guests per hour, showing just how slow bobsleigh was, even on a peak operating day. While the original Matterhorn features a ride layout that weaves in and out of the mountain structure it was designed around, bobsleigh is uniquely different in this aspect, as, other than the chain lift hill at the start of the ride, the coaster does not spend any time inside the mountain structure, instead weaving around the side of the mountain as it slowly makes its way back to the station. This saved on costs over the long run for the upkeep of the ride, as not as much energy needed to be devoted to the theming and upkeep of the interior of the mountain space, it could basically look super ugly because nobody was going to see it. Instead, riders enjoyed an outside and up-close view of the mountain as they took in the rest of the park from the top of the ride. The ride was designed by Sansei Technologies, a Japanese theme park company based in Osaka. Sansei got its start in the early 1950s, and bobsleigh was only the second roller coaster the company had ever designed at the time of Dreamland's opening in 1961. Over the lifetime of the company, it has only designed about 24 roller coasters, mostly for Japanese theme parks. If you visited Fuji Q Highland at all on your travels through Japan, they were one of the biggest purchasers of Sansei roller coasters throughout the years, though most of them have been removed from the park as of this recording in 2024. Only their coaster, Rock'n'Roll Duncan, still operates at the park today. However, Sansei is well known in the theme park industry for two other major reasons. Their roller coasters not being the popular product they may have assumed they would become when they first started designing them. First, while their roller coasters were never a commercial success, their design and manufacturing of other theme park rides has become very popular over the years, with large parks like SeaWorld, Nagashima Spa Land, Legoland, and Disney investing heavily in their rides over the years. SeaWorld San Diego has the Sansei-built observation tower still in operation at their park, for example. Legoland Japan also has an observation tower and a teacup ride, both manufactured by Sansei. Nagashima Spa Land has 5 Sansei rides in their park, including, surprise, an observation tower, a topspin ride, and a paratrooper ride. However, the biggest customer for Sansei rides over the years has easily been Disney parks. Sansei has helped to design and build the Buzz Lightyear spin rides that are found at just about every Disney park in the world, as well as the Little Mermaid Ariel's Undersea Adventure Omnimover ride found at both American parks, and the Navi River Journey found in Pandora at Animal Kingdom. Even if their roller coaster business never took off quite like it was expected to, their flat ride attractions has certainly made an impact on theme parks across the world, thanks to their working relationships with so many large parks. Second, Sansei over the years has become a well-known brand in the theme park world because they have grown into a massive company, buying up other companies to absorb into their growing portfolio of products. In November of 2012, Sansei announced that they had purchased a majority share of the company SNS Worldwide, a roller coaster manufacturing company based in Utah. And trust me, we are not about to go do a deep dive into the entire history of SNS Worldwide right now, or this podcast episode would literally be 2 hours long. But by the time it was purchased by Sansei in 2012, SNS had itself bought out a few large coaster companies during its business days, including Aerodynamics and Custom Coasters International. So the roller coaster portfolio that Sansei was buying in 2012 was huge, and it consumed a large part of all steel roller coasters produced worldwide in the late 20th century. Not happy with only owning some of the steel roller coasters in the world, Sansei also purchased Vekoma in 2018, bringing another large ride design company under their parent company as one of their subsidiaries. Today, both Vekoma and SNS Worldwide continue to operate as their own branded companies, producing roller coasters branded with these two companies' names on them. However, behind the curtain, Sansei Technologies owns both of these companies and got their start in Japan through these small roller coaster builds like bobsleigh at Nara Dreamland. If Nara Dreamland had never existed, it's questionable whether Sansei would be here today, if I'm being honest. When Dreamland opened in 1961, bobsleigh was a major opening day attraction for the park. Had the partnership with Disneyland worked out, it would have been labeled as an e-ticket attraction. Besides bobsleigh, Nara offered 2 other large e-ticket roller coasters for guests to ride, neither of which were direct replicas from Disneyland. Asuka was a wooden roller coaster modeled after Cyclone at Coney Island, and would have been the only wooden roller coaster at a Disney park had the park joined the Disney portfolio. Screw Coaster opened in the 1970s, was a double looping aero design coaster that is similar to Corkscrew at Cedar Point. Together, all three of these coasters offered guests visiting Nara Dreamland a chance to experience some unique, one-of-a-kind thrills in the region. Rides that were not as readily available at Japan during this time as they might have been in other areas of the world, like North America. This should have been a massive success for Dreamland, and it was for many years. But just like how the deal with Disney Parks quickly and suddenly collapsed, the future of Dreamland and bobsleigh turned just as quickly in the 1980s. By the early 1980s, Walt Disney had already passed away, leaving the future of his animation company and theme parks to family members and executive heads. Kenzo Matsuo was also reaching the end of his life. As I said, he passed away in 1984. Together, these two giants built two successful parks together, but on opposite sides of the world. They almost went into business together, but managed their parks separately, but still successfully, when the deal fell through. But the two companies would cross paths again in the 1980s, leading to the eventual closure of Nara Dreamland. By the late 1970s, Disney had successfully opened two theme parks in America, with the blueprint for a third park, Epcot, already in the planning stages of development. The parks were a financial success for the company, and allowed for Disney to remain profitable even as their movie business revenue shrunk in the 1970s. Naturally, then, further park expansion was in the cards for Disney. And this time, Disney Parks had their eyes set on Japan again, as the target for their first international expansion. In 1979, the Oriental Land Company contacted Disney to see if they were interested in bringing the magic of Disney to a Japanese audience. They were, big surprise, and a deal was worked out. This was a full deal that included licensing rights to the Oriental Land Company in their Tokyo park, including the use of the name Disney. Unlike the relationship that Disney and Matsuo had in the 1950s, this business deal was more than just a gentleman's agreement and would be the catalyst of a theme park revolution in Japan in the 1980s. Tokyo Disney opened in 1983 and was immediately loved by guests, a carbon copy in many aspects of Disneyland. Much like the original plans for Nara Dreamland, Tokyo Disney hoped to recreate the success of Disneyland Park by replicating everything that had worked in Anaheim, just placing it in Tokyo instead. Unlike Dreamland, however, Tokyo Disneyland felt legit, mainly because it was legit. It had the right to use Disney's name on its products, it had the Disney characters, and it had the Disney rides. Suddenly, Dreamland, which had seemed so cute and quaint and unique when it first opened, started to look and feel like a stale and cheap knockoff of a real Disney park. Despite the history of the park's relationship with Disney, guests didn't want the generic brand that Nara Dreamland gave them. They wanted Disney. And at first, after Tokyo Disneyland opened, things were, well, they were okay for Dreamland. I'm not saying they were great, but Tokyo Disneyland was located about a 6-hour drive from Nara Dreamland, which meant that they were attracting different crowds of people to their parks. But as the success of Tokyo Disney grew, so did its reputation. And slowly, people were willing to travel the miles to visit the Disney park from all over Japan, and even abroad. And this meant that they were skipping Dreamland completely. Slowly, Dreamland's bottom line began to suffer, and the once profitable park began to see a downturn in attendance and in profits. If you've been online and have watched any videos of the final years of Nara Dreamland's operation, you've seen a park that must have been wonderful in its heyday, but by its final years felt so worn down and so unkempt. A lot of the walkthrough videos you find online from the park's operating days show a place that feels straight out of the 1960s, with little to no updates provided to the place over the years. If you've ever watched a video on life in Cuba in the 1990s, it really feels similar to that. Cubans were driving around in their 1950 vehicles because it was all that was available to them, while the rest of the world had moved on to more modern options. The rides themselves began to fall into a state of disrepair that stayed with the park through the end of its operating days. Bobsleigh, once the crowning opening day jewel of the park, took on an aged and very weathered look. The paint on the track began to wear away, and this left the ride with a splotchy appearance throughout the ride's layout. The cars, which were original to opening day, at least as far as I could find, looked really dated too. I mean, they were cute, a little bit of a mid-century vintage vibe going for them, but knowing that they were original to the ride didn't really help alleviate any safety concerns that you might have had. Large sections of the land surrounding bobsleigh became overgrown as the years went on too, with a few online videos showing riders encountering trees and bushes and other greenery right next to their car as they completed a loop on the track. I wouldn't say it was so overgrown it was a safety hazard. I mean, they definitely trimmed some of it, and enough of it to not become a real danger, but it helped to reflect in the shabbiness of the ride and in the park in general. Overall, Nara Dreamland needed a good power washing, a good cleaning, some new paint, maybe a ride or two, just to turn its fortunes around. But it never came toward the park. The Disney experiment in Tokyo had become a wild success by the 1990s, leading other large American theme park companies to look at expansion into the country as well. And they weren't the only ones looking to get in on the profits either. Daiei, a large Japanese supermarket chain, bought Nara Dreamland in 1993. With the hopes that profits would be there for an already well-established theme park located only 40 kilometers from Osaka. What Daiei didn't realize, however, was that by 1993, guest attendance for Dreamland had already fallen under 1 million visitors a year and would continue to freefall for the next decade or more. What seems to have been the final death blow for Dreamland came in 2001, with the opening of Tokyo DisneySea and Universal Studios Japan in Osaka. Tokyo DisneySea's opening, though still a bit of a trip from Nara Dreamland, made the Japanese Disney Resort a travel destination when it opened. You could now visit both parks, book a hotel, spend a weekend with friends and family, and have a really great time. It continued to be a driving factor in contributing to the downward spiral of Dreamland. Universal Studios Japan was a bigger blow to the park, however, opening in Osaka, just 40 kilometers away from Nara Dreamland. Prior to the opening of Universal Studios Japan, Dreamland could still count on a reliable local audience that they could attract over an operating season. Sure, this attendance was still lower than what they once saw through the park entrance, but it was enough to keep the lights on at the park. With Universal opening in 2001, local guests stopped visiting Dreamland, opting for the newer, flashier American-based park that was literally just down the road. Dreamland's attendance numbers did a complete nosedive, plummeting to 400,000 park guests in an operating season, way down from their peak of 1.7 million visitors. The writing was on the wall for Nara Dreamland, but it inched along for a few more years in hopes of reversing its bad luck. There seems to have been no real plan to save the park, though, other than let's wait and see, and that's never going to be a successful plan overall. By 2004, the park was barely operational. Large sections of Dreamland had been boarded up and basically abandoned, with rides showing large amounts of neglect. As employees were let go to cut costs, some guests found employee service trucks that were just left completely abandoned in the park grounds, with no one operating them. The final day of operation for Nara Dreamland came on August 31st, 2006, with the park permanently closing afterwards. Now, when most theme parks close, the management company tries to liquidate whatever assets they may have left to manage financial losses as much as possible. Usually that means that rides are sold off, land is parceled out to developers, and changes take place to update a failed business location. Except in this case, Daiei didn't do any of that when Dreamland closed, essentially abandoning the project and the debt and all the rides when the park closed. Eventually, Nara City ended up obtaining the ownership of the land and all of its rides when Daiei basically stopped paying property taxes. But now the abandoned park became a government problem to solve, and we all know how quickly governments work to solve problems, right? So what happened was Dreamland just sat there, completely abandoned and rusting away. In the 2010s, it became quite common for urban explorers to hop the chain-link fence and photograph the park in its abandoned state. Everything had basically been left as it once had been, with price tags still on menu boards, chairs still at tables, and ride vehicles still at the station platform waiting for guests. Bobsleigh's Mountain, though looking worse for wear, was regularly climbed by daring urban explorers looking to get a bird's eye view of the park that was slowly being reclaimed by nature. There are mixed reports out there whether Nara City officials cared that so many urban explorers were descending on the park during these years. On one hand, there are multiple online accounts of people being caught by a security team and escorted off property. On the other hand, there are so many photos and videos that exist of an abandoned Nara Dreamland that it seems the effort to crack down on trespassers was maybe lukewarm at best. But by 2016, locals reported that funding had finally been approved to demolish the old park a decade after it had finally closed its gate for good. The work began in 2016 and continued until almost the end of 2017, with absolutely nothing being saved from the demolition team. All the rides, including bobsleigh, were torn down and scrapped. Future plans for the land have been rumored to include a new theme park, a water park, a hotel, and many other options. But as of this episode, no solid plans have been made for the land. Nara Dreamland seems to be the last thing that wanted to inhabit this space. Though both the theme park and roller coaster have now been closed for almost 20 years, the legacy of bobsleigh and Nara Dreamland continue to reverberate throughout the theme park industry today. First, and maybe most importantly, Nara Dreamland showed that the idea of a theme park could not only be copied in other countries outside of America, but it could find a lot of success in operating. Dreamland, we could argue, was probably way ahead of its time when it opened in 1961, but it proved a proof of concept that people were looking to theme parks to fill their leisure time. Second, bobsleigh shows how new engineering concepts of the 1960s could result in a fun steel roller coaster for anyone to enjoy. Steel coasters were just beginning to make their appearance in the world at this time, and though a handful of coasters had already been operating in Japan from Sansei and Togo, bobsleigh was the first successful coaster that married together American technology from the Matterhorn with Japanese building and ideas. The marriage of American technology and Japanese ideas hasn't always seen this successful of results over the years. Windjammer surf racers, anyone? But in the case of bobsleigh, it proves to be a winning combination and a large draw to the park throughout its entire operating life. Finally, though, we can argue that Disney successfully destroyed Nara Dreamland, whether they did that intentionally or not, and Dreamland managed to help solidify Sansei as a company through their bobsled design. That has spawned today into a conglomerate that not only owns literally half the roller coasters in the world, but has also partnered with Disney Parks to create some of the most iconic rides that the park has to offer to guests. In a lot of ways, Disney owes some of its success to Nara Dreamland for providing them with future innovation for their rides. In the end, it's very sad that Dreamland isn't open anymore, as it was a testament to how forward-thinking its owner was when the concept was dreamt up in the 1950s. Dreamland was kind of a magical place to visit, even if it wasn't quite as magical as a Disney park might have been. It provided decades of entertainment for guests who visited, and another decade of beautiful images that emerged during its years of abandonment. It's one of those parks that you always wonder what might have happened to it if any number of things had happened differently. Would it still be here today if Disney had licensed its characters to the park? Or would it still be here today if a better company had purchased it in the 1990s? Or would it still be here today if Universal Japan had decided to build their resort somewhere else? It's all speculation at this point, but it would have been nice to still be able to visit Nara Dreamland today. Well, after what feels like a very long story, we have finally reached the end of the episode and the end of our only international episode of Season 6. Nara Dreamland has been, well, a dream to cover this episode, and we hope that you've had as much fun listening to us as we've had talking about it. As a side note before we sign off for the episode, if you haven't had a chance to check out any of the Urban Explorer videos or photo galleries online of the abandoned Dreamland, I highly recommend you check some of them out when you have the chance. They're really fun to look at and gives you a sense of how detailed the park once was during its heyday of operation. With that, though, I'll be signing off on another episode of Once Upon a Coaster. We'll be back in 2 weeks with even more fun planned for you as we chat some more about some old roller coasters that we all love. As always, I'm Lizzie, and thank you so much for listening. Stay safe, be well, and I'll talk to you real soon. Bye!
Once Upon a Coaster is an independently run and produced podcast show. Today's episode was written and hosted by Lizzie. Additional writing and research by Rachel Macquarie and Matt Day. Accessibility support by Jacqueline Falker. Our Buy Me a Coffee content creator is Kelby Fox. We have IT support from Patrick McCoy. This episode cannot be reproduced or replicated in any form without the express written permission of our podcast. A special thank you to our Buy Me a Coffee supporters and to all coaster lovers everywhere who tune into our show.